For those of you who don't know Dr. Hirsky, let me just provide a quick introduction. Dr. Paul Hirsky is a graduate of the National College of Naturopathic Medicine, where he graduated in 1986 and where he also began to teach homeopathy. He's a diplomat of the Homeopathic Academy of Naturopathic Physicians, and he maintains an active practice in Enfield, Connecticut. Dr. Hirsky was first exposed to homeopathy for his own private medical needs as a teenager, and then shortly after experiencing some profound effects from homeopathy, he actually decided to pursue a career in the field. Paul was a voracious reader of the old literature. And when he was a student actually at the Naturopathic College in Portland, he would literally go through the old libraries and just read through the old journals. So his real primary teachers were people like Hahnemann and Kent, Bunninghausen, Herring, Lippe, and it was really from those readings that he began to understand the importance of writing and teaching from one's own clinical experience. Dr. Hirsky was also credited with revitalizing the homeopathic approach to the treatment of children through his very well-known book, The Homeopathic Treatment of Children, Pediatric Constitutional Types. He's also the author of an excellent work called Stramonium, with an introduction to the analysis of using cycles and segments. And he's also more recently published a couple of books on provings, volumes 1 and 2, which are excellent works that discuss the whole theoretical aspect of what a proving is really all about. Dr. Hirsky has also published numerous articles in major homeopathic journals. He was one of the people who was involved in revitalizing and helping to recreate the Homeopathic Academy of Naturopathic Physicians in the late 80s. He also began the concept of case conferences in the 80s and the 90s. He was the publisher of the New England Journal of Homeopathy, and he and his wife, Dr. Amy Rothenberg, started and still run the New England School of Homeopathy, which has courses actually throughout the world, England, Germany, Sweden, Norway, Austria, South Africa, Belgium, Italy. He's actually an internationally recognized teacher. Dr. Hirsky more recently developed a model of homeopathy called cycles and segments. Hopefully he can share a little bit about that. And in 1999, he began publishing an excellent letter, which is a bi-monthly email letter called the Hirsky Letter, which is essentially a distance learning program which gives people an opportunity to work through cases and really develop a cohesive understanding to the study and practice of homeopathy. So, Paul, thank you again for joining us. Let me just say as a personal aside that Paul was my primary instructor and mentor in homeopathy, and as a personal testimony to his efficacy as a practitioner, I have to say that in the 2.5-3 years that I actually worked with him in his office, we would receive referrals from other very well-known, world-recognized homeopaths, and I would say that most of the time, even with these very difficult cases, most of the time during that period of time that I was in his office, Dr. Hirsky was able to resolve those cases. And this was actually even before he had developed the language of cycles and segments. So even back then, his ability to practice at a high level of success and reproducibility even existed back then. So again, Paul, thank you so much for joining us. It's a great pleasure. For those of you who don't know, Dr. Hirsky will be one amongst a number of different world-recognized homeopaths who will be speaking at this year's upcoming 2010 LIGA conference, which will be in Redondo Beach, California, from May 18th through the 22nd. Dr. Hirsky will be joined by other well-known homeopaths like Andre Sain, Dr. Will Taylor, Dr. Farouk Master, Dr. Frederick Schroyens, Dr. Roger Morrison, and many others. So, Paul, thank you so much. We know you're a busy fellow, and we appreciate you taking the time to join us.
Well, thanks for having me.
You know, Paul, you've been doing a lot of work recently, I know, you're conducting some research, and I thought perhaps you could just start by sharing a little bit about the work you're doing and why you're doing this work and what do you feel the significance of it is.
Well, I guess I would just follow, this is the third or fourth of these calls that we've had over the years, and I guess I would just pick up from where I left off last year or so, which is that one of my main interests has been to try to understand the sort of rules of life, if you will, the way living systems behave given different environmental stressors. And the main species I work with is people, and the main subspecies I work with in their subpopulation are kids, and within that, even the main subpopulation are kids with neurologic and diseases and cognitive difficulties and so on. So it, as I'm working through this, I guess true to what your introduction was and what I wrote about in that first pediatric book, I thought that one of the most important things is just sort of trying to understand what works and what really doesn't work and writing it down. And to do that, you kind of have to work from your own experience and see what really does and doesn't work. And as I did that, you know, I wrote that first book, and that kind of, you know, I guess spoke for itself. But then as the cases got more and more difficult and the material started, you know, the materia medica just wasn't up to the cases that we were having, we needed to figure out a different way to better articulate what makes one remedy a remedy versus another remedy. In other words, when we look at ADHD, for example, and you look at two remedies like hyoscyamus overatrium or hyoscyamus and tarantula and so on the caricature level, you can say that they look very different from each other, that they, you know, one is restless and one is deceptive and one is, you know, like that. But actually, when you meet the patients, they're very similar to each other. And I know you and I had this long conversation about this in the mid-90s.
I remember, Paul.
When I said, you know, we need a new way to be able to describe this thing is what I said. And you said, you know, aside from that, there's going to be this big thing coming. It's called the World Wide Web. Do you remember that?
Yeah, I remember, yeah.
You said it's going to take over everything. It's going to be fantastic. So anyway, the long and short of it is when you look at a class of patients and a class of remedies, they share many, many symptoms. Sometimes they share, you know, 90-some-odd percent of the symptoms that you'll see in one patient in one remedy will be shared by another patient in another remedy. And so the question is not so much what makes in what are the symptoms of one remedy, but rather how do you differentiate these remedies from each other truly, not like what somebody said or some book said or whatever, but really how do you actually do it. And so to do that, I kind of worked and worked and worked and came up with that concept of cycles and segments that is more of a discovery rather than an invention. It's more of a just one of the larger rules of health and disease, and which I described in a bunch of different places. So that's the work that that's one of the pieces of work that I've been doing through the last decade. But I had also been working in other places. As you know, since the early 90s, I was talking about the sort of coming epidemics and the flus that are going to be coming and so on, and just what we need to do for preparedness and so on. And I basically kept on working in that arena year in, year out. And last 2 years ago, with a group of people in Portland and Seattle, we started doing some work in earnest of designing clinical trial for testing efficacy. And the first step was doing a sort of proof of concept, which is a case series. And in the case series, which was, I forget, 20-something patients, we had a very large difference between the people that took a homeopathic remedy and the people that did not take a homeopathic remedy. This was not blinded. It's just any sort of placebo-controlled. It's just a case series. But it was very strong signals. And then the next year we started working on the actual tools we would use in a clinical trial, developing the paperwork, going through IRB, doing all the stuff one does for a true scientific study. And in the midst of that, the swine flu hit while we're in the middle of this, actually finishing up the flu trial, and the flu sort of second proof of concept. And so what was interesting is in the midst of that work, we discovered some things that are not that surprising, but sort of speak to our community in general. One of the things we did is reviewed all the historical literature on the flu and homeopathy. Now, I'm not talking about respiratory tract infections or illnesses in general, but just actually the flus specifically. And we found just very few studies that actually were done on influenza and very few that were of any sort of quality. And so what we did is we went through all the different flu trials in medicine in our orthodox colleagues and just looked at what is considered a good clinical trial in flu. And then we looked at all the homeopathic trials and we started comparing and contrasting, and we then put together a document that got published eventually in the British Homeopathic Journal, now called Homeopathy, that spoke to how one would do a good clinical trial in influenza. Because, as you know, our little community is consistently being hammered by lack of efficacy trials and lack of any sort of statistically significant data that shows something works or doesn't work. The main reason being, not that it doesn't work, but that we don't do good work to show that it works. We don't approach the science of homeopathy, if you will, in a logical fashion. We just think that if we could just give remedies to people and they get better, that would be enough. And so what we did basically is we provided a kind of a roadmap for anybody that wants to do a trial on influenza to just sort of follow it. And if they followed that sort of inclusion and testing and exclusion and what kind of things you measure, then that trial should be accepted by actually anybody that does any sort of trials on influenza. It's actually up to snuff in terms of the science of it. While we were at it, we also put together another document that was published in the Journal of Complementary and Alternative Medicine on if you were to do a clinical trial on influenza using any CAM trial, what are the tools to use, in going through the whole history and all the meta-analyses and all that stuff, showing exactly the same thing, that in CAM in general, we don't have good clinical efficacy trials. And so at least one reason why our medical colleagues have a problem with us, part of it is bias, part of it is ignorance and so on, but part of it is just we don't actually have good proof for them. And what I'd like to do is help solve that. And one of the ways to help solve that is to actually show how to design a trial that would be useful for our community. So,
Paul, if people want to read more about this work, where would they go?
Well, you can go to the actual journals themselves, or you can go to, I think we have the links to it in the, if you go to herskulabs.org, so www.herskulaboratory.org, you just see just all the different papers that are published in different places. And then
H-E-R-S-C-U-L-A-B-S, is that correct?
or laboratory.
Or laboratory, Hirsky
yeah.
Laboratory.org.
Yeah.
Okay, great, fantastic.
And then, but if you, or you can go to the journals themselves, the Journal of Complementary and Alternative Medicine and Homeopathy, which is the British peer-reviewed journal. Interestingly enough, we were writing these papers through the winter, two winters ago, into the spring, and we submitted the papers, and then the swine flu hit, and we said, you know, I think it might be useful to to publish these really quickly, and they said, yes, we'll put a rush on it, meaning that they got published 9 months later. But they did allow us to put the raw paper on the websites before they got published. But you know, as we're working through it, there were you know, a lot of people that put a lot of energy into these papers with the idea that really one of the things that's missing in complementary medicine is just good science, which is not to say that it's not effective. It's just we can't show the effectiveness in a way that we ought to show. No,
go ahead, Paul.
And, you know, while I was at it, we also wrote another paper in a journal called Drug Discovery Today, which is the number one sort of journal for every vice president in the pharmaceutical industry that's in charge of setting up clinical trials and just looking at the science of it, talking about how to change the drug discovery pipeline to make it more effective. And we partnered with people from Harvard and because my honest to goodness belief is that there are some basic laws of nature that if you can articulate them clearly enough, should cross all boundaries and all sort of things that look dichotomous. And so there's a way to look at science that sort of crosses not just the treatment of people, the treatment of animals, the treatment of using homeopathy and using other modalities. In other words, how do you help the patient in front of you get the very best treatment they can at the time they see you, at the right dose, at the right frequency, so that they can establish a curative response? That thing is controlled by laws of nature, not by homeopathy. Homeopathy is one tool. It's a fantastic tool, but it's one tool that helps us to affect the curative response. But there's I think the highest level of physician should be able to help the patient find the best tools wherever they are. In fact, 5 minutes before this phone call, somebody called me because they were doing a some sort of backhand flip thing and just broke the radial head, a bone in the elbow, essentially. And they, besides the homeopathic remedy, which they needed, they also needed some other treatments, and trying to find the right treatment for the right person is what I'm most interested in. In terms of the, and I've done a bunch of different research that I've been involved with across many different lines. For example, when we were working with the flu, one of the things we established is something called clinical prediction tools, which is how do you describe a treatment, for instance, a homeopathic remedy, in a way, and this is a complex mathematical thing, but I'm going to describe it as a sort of narrative. How do you describe a homeopathic remedy in a way that fits that remedy, but at the same time excludes every other remedy besides this one remedy? It's like a Aristotelian syllogism, which is not simply these symptoms fit this remedy, because as you know, as we all know, many, many remedies are described by similar symptoms. The trick is not how do you do that, but how do you find the right remedy amongst all of the remedies that are described by these set of symptoms? And that part has not really been addressed in homeopathy previously. It's always been if it hurts, and if it's sore to be touched, and if the person says I'm fine and don't touch me and so on, all those symptoms point to arnica, which is true. But at the same time, not every person that has that in the middle of a trauma needs arnica. There's other remedies that are described in the same way. And so the question has always been, why are there so many failures in homeopathy? Why are there so many drug study failures in homeopathy? Why do we go to conferences and somebody presents a case and there's 100 participants in the class and they pick 30 or 40 remedies? How is that a science? And so my goal has been to try to have 100 people come to just 3 or 4 remedies and establish what's called a sort of a reliability, an inter-rater reliability, a way that each individual can look at a case in a way that leads to a certain level of predictability, a certain level of efficacy and predictability, and be able to articulate why they think that remedy, not other remedies. That's what's been interesting me for a long time, and that's what I've been working on. In fact, there's a conference this weekend that's put on by the National Center for Homeopathy, but it's a joint conference by a lot of the organizations, where I'm supposed to talk for a day. But my goal is to start the day by describing a case and having everybody work on that case, and then we'll have people pick the remedies they would give, and I'm sure it'll be the same thing. It'll be 30, 40 remedies. And then we'll go through the way I've described materia medica and case-taking and case analysis, and then we'll do the same thing again. And what I predict now, even though I can't show it to you right now, what I predict is that from the 30 remedies, we'll shrink down to a handful of remedies that the group will pick, and they'll do it themselves just by following a certain process, which I think is a step towards science.
Great. Paul, you mentioned cycles and segments just a moment ago, and then also you've been kind of alluding to your cycles and segments approach as a way of being able to differentiate one remedy from another and create a higher level of success in practice. So could you kind of just maybe give us a quick overview of what that approach is, so people have a sense of what you're talking about? And also, could you talk a little bit about your map of hierarchy and explain why you developed that and why you feel that these two things are important for developing and advancing homeopathy?
Okay, great. Well, first of all, the spirit of homeopathy, the sort of foundation of homeopathy, the philosophical legacy that Hahnemann left us is with the idea of treating the whole, that the whole gets sick, that the whole individual is diseased, the whole individual is dealing with the stresses of their environment and response by producing symptoms. That's all on the philosophy side. On the material, the tool side that we have a repertory that's just full of pieces of the whole. We have materia medica that's just pieces of the whole. We have Well, the tools that we use to come to the remedy are all pieces. And there's this sort of divergent, this sort of cognitive dissonance between our belief originally of why we join, why we become homeopaths, and then ultimately the tools that we use, looking in the rubric for this and looking at the Materia Medica for that. And I understand why it was written that way, but it nevertheless produces a certain problem. So the question is there a way to bring those two things together? Is there a way to marry the philosophy to the actual tools that we use? And there is, I think, by the way I look at it, which is that briefly, if you think of an individual that has certain levels of susceptibility, and I can go into like a whole discussion on that, which I don't think we have enough time. But because of that susceptibility, that individual is inclined to feel something in the surrounding as stressful. When they feel that stress, they have to respond to it. That response then produces all the signs and symptoms that they experience. Now, if you look at all those symptoms, there's a way to start structuring them. There's a way to start looking at them to see what's common between them. I guess Boninghausen was the first acknowledged one to do this, where he's describing, let's say, the three symptoms of sharp pain in the knee and sharp pain in the ankle and sharp pain in the eye and a headache that's a sharp pain, and saying all those things have sharp pains, and all the little specifics are just that, little specifics. But that the sort of more general structures is what is important. And that process that he began, though he made many, many mistakes, but that process that he began then led to where we are, which is that you can take all the symptoms of a remedy. You can take the 8,000 symptoms, 15,000 symptoms of a remedy, and be able to describe all of those symptoms in just a handful of larger ideas. And when you start to do it in that way, what you start to see is a pattern emerging that wasn't evident before when you just looked at the symptoms themselves. And what you start to see is that these pieces, these handful of large ideas, which I call segments, start to relate to each other, and that one leads to the next, which leads to the next, which leads to the next, and finally comes back again. In fact, it forms a kind of a cycle. And so the term cycle and segments are very sort of specific to the reality of the situation, which is that that there's this sort of actual pattern that diseases form, that individuals will describe, that in a way will encompass all the symptoms of a remedy. In a way, once you start seeing it that way, a lot of the divergences and a lot of the errors in homeopathy start to disappear. It starts to become very simple to see and to predict the symptoms that a remedy should have, and then indeed you look it up and they have, and the symptoms that they shouldn't have, and indeed you look it up and they don't have it. And what it's led to is a sort of elucidation of what makes one remedy different from another remedy, which is not so much the symptoms themselves, but the context that those symptoms develop within each of the remedies and within each of the individuals. And it's actually been quite wonderful in that it not only makes the practice of homeopathy a little bit more predictable and more accurate and more consistent, not just within one group, but within a whole population of homeopaths around the world. But it also fits nicely within, and I mean nicely, within the center of science, because all of science is moving in a certain direction, and this type of homeopathy actually sits right in the middle of it. The reason the map of hierarchy came along is because there, as I was saying earlier, there's a host of patients that just seem to need similar kinds of remedies. And when you start to look at them, let's say the patient needs hyoscyamus or torrential, let's say hyoscyamus, what you start to see is that every single hyoscyamus patient has a set of symptoms that are also common to sulfur and also common to metarhinum and also common to tuberculinum and so on. And when you start to prescribe correctly, what you start to see is a movement of sicker to healthier individuals, but at the same time, they seem to follow a certain pattern of remedy presentation. So if I could sort of describe it more fully, there are some individuals that just need one remedy for, really, no matter what happens in their life, they primarily will just do fine with sulfur, or they'll just do fine with calcarea. Very healthy, very robust people, which means that no matter what the stresses of life are that they're exposed to, they respond in a very similar pattern. That, yes, they might have different symptoms, but all those symptoms fit within the same architecture of that remedy. There's other people that, because of their genetics or because of, you know, lifestyle and so on, the level of pathology is such that when they're exposed to different environmental pressures, they can't maintain the same defense. They can't produce the same types of symptoms, and then they start producing a different set of symptoms. Not just different, but a different architecture. And then they need actually not one remedy for their whole life. They need one remedy, and after a period of time, maybe months, maybe years, they'll need a second remedy. And then as people get sicker, that process might continue and might expand. And what I realized is that homeopaths were having a problem because when a patient would come to them, they would see the calcarea carbonica symptoms, and at the same time, they would see the hyoscyamus symptoms, and at the same time, they might see metarhinum symptoms. They're having difficulties trying to understand what remedy to prescribe because all those symptoms appeared or were thought to appear at the same time, which is obviously a mistake, but it has that appearance. And so what the map of hierarchy describes is how to select the sort of worst state and prescribe for that. And it's, in a way, it's Herring's law, but not of individuals. It's Herring's law looking at remedies as a group, and that in general, as patients get sicker, they go in one direction of remedies. And as they get healthier, they go in a different direction. In other words, in the sort of fourth quadrant, I have a remedy, tarantula. And in the first quadrant, I have a remedy, sulfur. And all things being equal, the tarantula patient would be a sicker patient than a sulfur patient. And all things being equal, you would be prescribing the tarantula rather than the sulfur. And all things being equal, the tarantula patient would not stay as a tarantula patient after getting tarantula. In other words, there's no such thing as a healthy tarantula patient, but there is healthy sulfur patients. So it's a way to help homeopaths look at patients and be able to better understand what to prescribe upon. You know, when you first start studying homeopathy, they say things like, you know, a homeopathic remedy, a patient is presents in such a way that's sort of like a onion with these layers and so on, and that's all nice and neat and all, it just doesn't really relate to reality, in that the vast majority of patients, not the incredibly healthy ones that just have only one remedy, but the vast majority of other patients have a constellation of symptoms, and those symptoms look like they could fit several different remedies, and that leads to that whole sort of mistake that seems to have plagued our profession from day one, that I've been trying to help.
And obviously, Paul, this is an important issue for prescribing, because if you give one of the lesser pathological remedies, you could actually make the patient worse.
If you give calcarea to somebody that needs tarantula, it's possible that those calcarea symptoms will improve, but at the same time, the tarantula symptoms will worsen. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Paul, I know we don't have a great deal of time, but you had mentioned something which I thought was rather interesting, which is that within the idea of cycles and segments, the description of the remedy is so, I won't say comprehensive, but it's so incisive that you're able to distinguish this remedy from any other remedies. And I was wondering if you could give an example of, you know, and I know you don't have a lot of time, but do you think it's possible to give a quick example of the description of one of these remedies from the perspective of cycles and segments and how it really distinguishes it from all other remedies? I know it's a tall order, and if you don't feel it's...
yeah, a tall order. It would just seem like a caricature.
Okay,
and
all right.
Out of...
All right, well, maybe for some future call, I'll get you early in the call and you can answer that. So let me ask you another question then.
Yeah.
I know you've done a lot of work with treating neurological complaints and even genetic disorders and ADD and ADHD and all these things. So I'm curious, what is yours? You've got so much experience. What do you feel is the role of homeopathy in the treatment of these types of conditions? Chromosomal issues, ADHD, neurological complaints, all of that stuff.
Right. I think it has a very important role, and I've written a lot about this and taught a lot about this, and saw a lot of patients in front of a lot of homeopaths around this. There are so many things a homeopath could do and should do. Most of it is. Very hard to do in a few minutes. Homeopaths, giving the right homeopathic remedy can help the vast majority of people that have ADHD not have ADHD. That's just a straight out simple fact.
Right.
Most homeopaths, you know, can I just spend the remainder of the time on this and we'll just go in depth on one point and then...
Yeah, sure, Paul.
Okay.
Whatever you feel is most relevant.
Okay, so let me start off by saying most people don't know the actual diagnosis of ADHD. If I polled the actual individuals on this phone call, the actual homeopaths, the vast majority of them have a sense of what ADHD means, but the actual diagnostic criteria, they don't know. That's a mistake that should be fixed. It takes like all 10 minutes to fix it or 15 minutes, say, to fix it, and then we would know that. That same sort of lack of knowledge is true in our medical colleagues as well. Except for some pediatricians that actually go through the whole process, the vast majority of us don't actually know the history behind the diagnosis, the first books that came out with that diagnosis, and its evolution to where it is today. That lack of knowledge presents an opportunity for homeopaths to help. It also presents a hindrance. And when I say that, it's because at least in the last two iterations of of the diagnostic criteria, the diagnosis that's developed by the APA, they have ADHD as primarily and only an attentional issue problem. In other words, there is no temper tantrums and violence and all sorts of other things that we sometimes associate with ADHD. They just have basically issues around attention and movement. So that when many times parents come to a physician, be it a homeopath or a pediatrician, they say, help my kid, he's like bouncing all over the place and he's nasty and he's this and that. And the physician often and the parents often will shift towards an ADHD medication. However, when you look at the studies, and when you look very carefully at the studies, they say something like 80 or 85% of the patients that, or the kids that start these drugs, will have a fantastic result. 80 or 85%, that's an incredible number. If you look at those patients 2 months out, the result starts to drop. When you look at those patients a year out, half of those patients are off the drugs already. Why? Because what the parents thought they were getting, what they were hoping for, is to help the whole child. The moods, the focus, the outbursts, all of that stuff. But in fact, when those drugs work, they often work in a very local way. And for many children, they only work temporarily, leaving out the side effects, leaving out all the other stuff. Now, the thing that homeopaths aren't aware of is that success for these drugs is a 20 or 25% reduction of symptoms. And if we had time, which I don't think we have time, but I'll probably do this during this weekend at the NCH. If we had time, I would just go through how the diagnosis is made with ADHD and the scoring of it, and so on. And you come to this numerical figure of, let's say, 50 points, or let's say 40 points, and for success, from the drug point of view, it means 25% reduction of symptoms. In other words, the kid is still violent and tantruming and anxious, because none of that is ADHD. And at the same time, they're bouncing off the wall, but not quite as much. And at the same time, they're still not focusing, but not quite as much of an issue. And that's considered a success. And that will be held down for months and months and months as they change remedies, as they change drugs, as they change dosages, and so on. That same parent comes to a homeopath and says, help my son. And the expectation from the homeopath and the expectation from the parent is you've got your few days, you've got your month to fix the kid, or 6 weeks to fix the kid. And so what winds up happening is there's an unrealistic expectation to some of the patients and to the family, in that the patient might be improving with the correct remedy, and yet the time frame is not given the same chance as the drugs. So you see, we work under this sort of lack of knowledge of what our physician friends are doing and the sort of standards that they're kept up to, as opposed to what we're expecting from ourselves. As well, we don't have a quantitative tool to say how the patient is doing or not doing, which is, I think, a shame for homeopaths that don't know this, because it is an easy thing to do, to sort of chart out in a quantitative fashion, the symptoms that make up the current diagnosis of, let's say, ADHD. and then to compare them 6 weeks later, 7 weeks later, and say, you see, we have like a 20% reduction, we have a 40% reduction, and so on. So you can show it to the parent. You can show, you can demonstrate it and say, we have the same level of efficacy within 1 month that you would have on your standard ADHD drug without the toxicity, without the side effects, without the sleep disturbances, without the food, the diet change, and the sort of heart problems and so on. And at the same time, the child has gotten better in terms of their moods and in terms of their, you know, the rest of the other things. And so aside from the materia medica, aside from case-taking, aside from all the other problems that are sort of could be improved upon in our profession, at the very least, the general approach of the homeopath to the child with ADHD is an incomplete approach of knowledge, which is not one that takes a long time to learn. It's just one that we're sort of ignorant in, which is a shame, because when homeopathy started, when Hahnemann started, his case-taking, his science, was not an aside. It was at the very height of science. He was asking for the clearest, crispest way to judge a remedy, which is where the provens came from. The cleanest, crispest way to assess how a patient is improving, the quick, and so on and so on and so on. And through the decades and through these couple of centuries, homeopaths have sort of stepped aside and let the rest of science develop all sorts of fantastic tools that we should be aware of, we should be cognizant of, because it will help our science tremendously. As an aside, we had this terrible flu, that if you got the flu, there was a heightened state of a higher likelihood of developing complications of acute lung injury or ARDS, which is what people were some of the people were dying from. And you know, I kind of looked at the situation and thought there's got to be a way to treat it aside from the homeopathy, which, I mean, it'd be very hard for us to get into the intensive care unit around the world. But you know, I started working with different researchers, and you know, have been working on a molecule that seems that molecule will be quite effective in the treatment of ARDS. You know, you said that I've had papers published in you know, the homeopathic journals. In this last year, we published four articles in sort of first-tier medical review journals on just how to get CRISPR medicine, and it's, you know, it doesn't involve homeopathy, but it just involves good science, which I believe at the core of good science, homeopathy is right there. That's sort of a big piece for me.
Paul, I want to open it up and let some other people ask some questions, but before I do that, is there anything else you'd like to share, any other projects you're working on, books, or just anything you'd like to share you think might be of interest?
Let's see. I am still a couple of months away from finishing the ADHD book, as I've been for years. It's just that, like the first book, it's very easy for me to write, but what's important for me when I write is that what I write about is going to be true 100 years from now. And for that to be the case, you just need to have cases. And so I need hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of Veratrum children cases and hyoscyamus cases and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of Tarantula cases and hundreds and hundreds of Encinella cases and so on. And so that whole thing is done. I just have to find time to take it down to the editing stage and be done with it. Of course, the teaching in Boston and around the world. I'm still working on the flu trials. I'm intending on having a proving done, yet another proving, but this one I'd like done at all the naturopathic schools at the same time, which I think would be kind of interesting because the same molecule being proved in similar population of people, but in the Northwest, the Southwest, the Northeast, it's different environments and different. I'd be interested to see how that plays out.
Great.
Lots of projects.
That sounds great. Well, I know you're always a busy fellow. So for people who would like more information about Dr. Herskew or any of his work, or you'd like to find out more about the Herskew letter, which is, as I mentioned earlier, an excellent bi-monthly email letter, which is delivered directly to your email box and requires that you work through cases and is an excellent kind of home study course. Or if you want to just get information about any of the places where Dr. Herskew and his wife are offering their New England School of Homeopathy program, you can go to the website. It's www.nesh, that's N as in Nancy, E as in Elephant, S as in Sam, H as in Harry.com, www.nesh.com, and you can find out all kinds of information about Dr. Herskew, his books, and the other work that they're involved in. Let me also again mention that Dr. Herskew will be amongst a number of the top homeopathic instructors and practitioners from around the world who will be joining together for this upcoming 2010 LIGA conference in Redondo Beach, California. That will be running May 18th through May 22nd. And there still is a $50 discount available through April 15th. If you go to the LIGA website, which is www.LIGA2010, that's 2010.org, and you type in all caps, L as in Larry, M as in Mary, H as in Harry, I as in Iguana, 2010, that's all caps, LMHI 2010, you can get that additional $50 discount, and again, that's only good through April 15th. So I'm going to go ahead now and open up the lines, and for those of you who have some questions for Dr. Herskew, here's your opportunity. Any questions for Dr. Herskew?
I just have...
Hello, yes, my name's Carolyn. I'm a homeopath in Australia.
Go ahead.
Yes, I was very interested in Dr. Herskew's comment about people bringing their children with ADHD and other ASD types of disorders about not being prepared to give a homeopath as much time as they would a doctor. This is something that I find happens frequently. You do get occasional parents who are committed and willing to work with you come what may, but some people I do find make it quite hard because they want to get results very quickly. I wanted to ask Dr. Herskew if he ever discusses this with his patients in the beginning of treatment.
Great question, and I'll be in Australia in September, I think. The best way to deal with this is to discuss it with the patient up front and to say, here's your choices. You can do the sort of drug route, which about 50% of the people will stop after a year, which don't include these things that you're complaining about, which is all the violence and all of this and this and this. And even when they are used, and even when they are considered successful, the majority of them have just a partial success, and in a month's period of time and so on. If you know that and you can discuss it with the patient's family, then at the very least they should give you that, because in their minds what they're thinking about is, I could take Ritalin or I could take Vyvanse or something, and the child will be better within days. That's true for some of the kids. for the majority of the kids, that isn't true, and it isn't true in the long run, and that's the point. And the thing that most people aren't aware of is that school attendance years out. In other words, how many of the children flunk out? How many of the children are held back? The IQ, the working memory, the peer structure, none of that is, can you see the difference between the kids that have taken the drugs and the kids that have not taken the drugs years out? In other words, there is no real long-term benefit to those drugs, and those drugs don't tend to help the majority of the symptoms that the patient is really suffering from. They just are aimed at the attentional side of things. So the more you can make that case and with literature and with proof and so on, which there is ample proof of, the more time they'll give you. But it is an unfair and more or less a ignorant point of view for the physician to say, take this, things will be better, or things will be 85% better, or most likely to be better. And it's everybody working out of a kind of ignorance that allows that to happen. And I think the more you can educate the parent on that, and it shouldn't take very long. It could be just, you know, within 5 minutes, you can make all the points, and it'll be like, okay, I'm right with you, or let's give the drugs a chance, and they're not with you. But what's not fair is for them to say, we think that these drugs can work, and we're just going to give you a short period of time, because then there are mistakes happening all the way down. There's assumptions that are happening all the way through that are just incorrect.
Right.
Yeah,
we have time for probably one more question, so here's your opportunity.
I have a question.
Please go ahead.
Yeah, I wanted to ask, like, in the practice, the patient with the ADHD, have you found, is there any association with sugar, a sweet intake, or about the vaccinations?
Yeah.
Are there any association with the ADHD patient in the practice?
Yeah, that's a good question, and I'll tell you my answer to the several hundred questions that are the same question, which is sugar, vaccinations, television, loud music, school systems that change the subject every 20 minutes. All those things are stressors. How those stressors impact each individual is dependent on their susceptibility. And therefore, you can't say that sugar will be bad for everybody, because that's just not the case. Nothing is, with a certain dose, nothing is like all bad for all people at all time. Just like nothing is good for all people at all time. There's a sort of a susceptibility issue that has to be addressed, by which I mean some kids eat sugar and they're like just totally fine. Some kids eat sugar and they literally break the furniture in my office and reach for 100-year-old Materia Medica and rip it to shreds. But you can't say this is bad for all people. What you have to do is you have to see how this particular individual in front of you responds to different because of the susceptibilities to different stressors, and then what you will start to see is that there's a commonality to what they're susceptible to. There's a sort of a structure to the disease that they're producing, and it's in that that's what you try to match. And by matching that to a homeopathic remedy that produces the same set of symptoms, you make them less susceptible to those same environmental pressures. That's true for all the hundreds of things, food coloring and you know, sleep disturbance, all that stuff.
Great. Paul, well, thank you once again for a very informative, very illuminating discussion on various aspects of homeopathic practice. I'll see you in Virginia because I'm going to be there as well, so let's get together for a meal or something. When are you leaving, Paul?
I'm there Saturday.
All right, anyway, I'll get in touch with you. And can we give Dr. Hirsky a very big, warm North America doing such a great job?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Th